On the program today, the broad outlines of a new American industrial policy are taking shape. Also, another installment of our series, How the Deck is Stacked, from American Public Media. This is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Thursday, the 1st of December, if you can believe that. It's good as always to have you here, everybody. Dateline, Indianapolis, Indiana, the Carrier plant there, 3 p.m. or so Eastern time today.
Companies are not going to leave the United States anymore without consequences. Not going to happen. It's not going to happen.
President-elect Trump, as we've known for a day or two now, has done a deal with Carrier to keep slightly less than half the jobs the air conditioning and furnace company was going to send to Mexico here, about 1,000 in all. Very much carrot and stick, as that quote implies, the stick you just heard. Plus, he also said he was going to tax companies at the border. The carrot for Carrier is $7 million in Indiana state tax breaks and other incentives over 10 years. But the overall idea that more manufacturing jobs are leaving this economy than are staying is a familiar script. Marketplace's Annie Baxter gets us going.
It's been a really tough decade and a half for manufacturing in the United States.
Over that time, we've basically had two recessions. Each one cost the sector about 3 million jobs.
That's Josh Bivens with the Economic Policy Institute. He says some of the job losses have to do with the trade imbalance, demand for cheaper foreign products exceeding demand for American-made ones. Trade deals have also set the table for more outsourcing. A growing share of work is automated. And bucking those trends by adding jobs is not really part of the game plan, according to Jerry Davis, a management professor at the University of Michigan.
Companies don't have incentives to create jobs just to create jobs. They only create jobs as an investment in making money.
Davis says the market doesn't value keeping jobs and paying a workforce well, so there's not a lot of incentive to do so. Harvard University business professor Gary Pisano sees that sometimes as well.
I think a lot of companies, unfortunately, view the workers as a liability and see the cost.
Pisano says some firms get trapped in the short-term game of boosting profits to appease investors, and offshoring jobs is one way to do so, but that can be short-sighted.
It can appear that you're going to save a lot of costs, but maybe you're not. You know, maybe over the long term, you're going to lose certain kinds of capabilities that you need to adapt and to innovate.
Still, Pisano says most companies that were going to offshore have already done so. The bigger factory job killer these days, he says, robots. I'm Annie Baxter for Marketplace.
With the coming Trump administration and Republican control of Congress will come tax reform. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer reports now on what changes are in the works and what effect they might already be having.
Wealth managers are trying to figure out exactly how Donald Trump would change the tax code. It isn't easy.
We're looking at each tweet as it comes out to see how it may affect our tax planning.
That's David Dietz. He's founder and president of Point View Wealth Management. He says Donald Trump has given tax planners some clues about what he'll do. On his website, Trump says he'll cut the top tax rate to 33% and cap itemized deductions for married joint filers to $200,000. Currently, there is no cap. The proposed deduction cap is already affecting charitable giving, with wealth advisors like attorney Carlin McCaffrey telling their clients, give to your favorite charity now while you can still deduct all of your charitable contributions.
I think it makes sense for people who can afford to do it this year to think about doing it, accelerating their charitable giving.
Now, Donald Trump's tax proposals would have to be approved by Congress and could very well be changed on their way through the legislative process. But it does look like Republicans will get some kind of tax reform done, says William Gale, co-director of the Tax Policy Center.
There's both a plan in the House and a plan in the Senate. There's a lot of people that have been involved in this in a long time and want to work it out.
In the meantime, wealth advisors will keep reading the tea leaves and Donald Trump's tweets to try to keep their clients from being hit with big tax surprises next year. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, it was a tale of two sectors. Financials up, big tech down. We'll have the details when we do the numbers.
Hi.
Hi, how are you? I'm Kai.
Tony.
Nice to see you, Tony. How are you?
Tony Burbat and his wife, Laura, live in Midlothian, Illinois. It's a town of 15,000 people, about 25 miles south of Chicago.
Holy cow. Hi, everybody. Wow, it's the whole crowd.
The whole gang's ready.
They own a home, a small one, about 1,000 square feet, but in it live seven people.
Kai, this is Michael, Jamie, Olivia, Laura, Sam, Tony, and Tony.
And two dogs. I'm here because the Burbats are among the 77 million Americans who have a debt in collections.
Do you remember the first time you got a call from collections on your debt?
Yeah, I mean, the first time it feels pretty bad. I mean,
I remember not answering the phone a lot. Do you remember that? Just don't
answer. Just don't answer. It was one solution.
Tony and Laura Burbat are in their early 50s. They've got two sons and two daughters. When their son Michael was born with special needs, Laura quit her job to stay home and take care of him, and that made money tight.
As we got into this cycle where when we had to, we would take a cash advance against credit card to get by. And then when it got too bad, what we'd do is we'd refinance the
house. Right, take money out of the house.
And then you pull money out of equity, and that would buy you a couple of years. And then when that started getting thin, cash advances again, whatever you had to do to survive. And then when that started to look really bleak, we would refinance the house again and pay off the cash advances. And that mountain just kept getting a little higher with every time.
Tony kept the family's financial problems from Laura for a while.
I came to her one day and said, you know, we got to sit down and we got to talk because I'm good at handling pressure, but it got to the point where I just didn't see a light at the end of the tunnel anymore.
How much money are we talking about? How much did you owe?
Oh, I would say around a couple hundred thousand. Initially, when we first started talking about it, I wanted to file bankruptcy
because
I wanted the easy way out. And Laura didn't see it the same way morally.
How'd you see it?
I just don't want to do that. It just didn't feel like the right way to me. I don't know. I felt like we should pay it all back.
Bankruptcy would be cheating.
We're going to be hearing a lot in the next couple of months, with the Trump administration and its spending plans and Republicans in charge of things in Washington, about the federal debt. But what the government owes is less important to the national economy than what you owe. This is the latest installment of our series with Frontline and PBS NewsHour called How the Deck is Stacked.
Public debt is really a sideshow relative to the private debt explosion that we've seen over the last 20, 20, 30 years.
Amr Soufi is an economist at the Booth School of Business at the University of Chicago. He's also the co-author of the book House of Debt. Today, Americans as a whole owe more than $12 trillion. Mortgages, credit cards, student loans, and cards. Numbers dangerously close to where they were before the recession.
If I say we've got a private debt crisis in this country, am I overstating the case?
No, I think, of course, there's a private debt crisis. I think if you
look say that like everybody knows it.
Yeah, but I mean, look, I think the two periods we had in the last century when you saw sharp rises in debt are right before the Great Depression and right before the Great Recession. So if you look at the long history of the last century, the two times where private debt burdens seemed out of control are exactly when we saw severe economic downturns. So that's where we are, I think.
Wages, as we've told you many times, have been relatively stagnant for decades. But as money has gotten harder to earn, it has gotten easier to borrow, even for Americans who really shouldn't.
Why do companies, credit card companies, auto loan companies, why do they lend to people who can't necessarily pay it back when they know that the people can't pay it back?
Well, oftentimes they're not the ultimate lender. They're just originating the loan. They're selling it for a fee, and so they're not so interested in whether the person can pay or not.
But the financial sector says, hey, man, it is our job to let capital flow through this economy, to make sure that people who want access to credit can have it. Don't look at me.
No, I mean, I think that's a new way of thinking. I think the analogy I would give is smoking. So we know that smoking can be bad for you. We know that secondhand smoke has a problem. I think we're at a point now where we know excessive borrowing by certain individuals is not only bad for the individual, but bad for the overall economy.
So we need a Janet Yellen warning on all loan applications?
maybe.
Excessive borrowing could be injurious to your health.
Yeah. Exactly.
Part of the reason borrowing has gotten so much easier in the past couple of decades is because a whole industry has sprouted up around it, buying and selling debt, which is where this guy comes in.
Dave Ludwig, the president of National Loan Exchange.
When you go to a cocktail party and somebody says, Dave, what do you do? What do you say?
I'm a doctor.
Dave Ludwig is a bad debt broker. It's sort of like a real estate agent, except instead of working with clients to buy or sell houses, He works with banks and other lenders to sell their charged-off debt.
Charge-off means they just get it off their books. Right.
They, an account goes so many days delinquent.
Right.
Today, they have to charge off, a bank has to charge off a revolving account at 180 days.
Revolving accounts or credit cards, all that
credit
stuff.
Credit cards, unsecured consumer loans.
If you don't start paying a loan back in 6 months, by law, the lender has to declare it a loss. But that doesn't mean it goes away. The bank does one of three things with it. One, it keeps trying to collect the money itself. Two, it hires what's called a third-party debt collector to recover the money for a fee. Or three, it can sell the debt. And that's where Dave comes in.
So give me a hypothetical case study. Bank of America, Wells Fargo, I don't care what it is. They come to you and they say, Dave, I've got $50 million in charge-offs that I want you to handle for me. Then what happens?
First, I tell them I love you. we request personal information on the debtors, financial information, and a kind of a synopsis of what's happened to the accounts.
So big data, right? I mean, yeah. You want all the data.
What the buyers are looking for is how complete that data is. You can't collect an account if you can't find them. So all of that goes into a machine and spits out a number of what we believe the price range is.
Cents on the dollar. You guys are figuring out, here's $50 million of debt, and we figure that this is worth 4 cents on the dollar.
Correct.
The debt collection companies that buy debt get it so cheap that even if they can only get people like the Burbats to pay a fraction of what they owe, they're coming out way ahead. And once they're done getting what they can, they often turn around and sell the remaining debt to a smaller shop who then picks at the scraps.
There's a market for anything in this industry. There's a market for deceased accounts.
Dead people.
Chapter 7.
Bankruptcies.
Out of statute accounts.
Debts that aren't legally enforceable anymore.
Doesn't mean it's not collectible.
The further down the chain, the less the debt is worth, but it is still worth something.
If there's things from a 20th of a penny, but if you have 100 million of that.
Collecting all that debt, of course, takes people. There are more than 350,000 people working in debt collection in this country.
My name is Alice Hanners, and I just turned 28.
Alice Hanners used to be one of them. She lives in Buffalo, New York, and when she graduated college a couple of years ago and couldn't find a job in graphic design, she took whatever she could to get by, which in Buffalo is basically debt collection.
90% of what I saw was debt collection.
The city has become a hub for that industry, and with other jobs going away, it provides a decent paycheck for workers with little experience.
It's a very weird position to be in because you're essentially asking people to pay for something they already own.
Alice says that every morning she would get a list of names with phone numbers and the amount that people owed. People like the Burbats.
I would say on a slow day, I would do 20 calls per hour. On a really good day, like 60.
In the past several years, the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau has been cracking down on the debt collection industry with new regulations and huge fines levied on the industry's biggest offenders.
I think a lot of people assume you just call up and be like, well, you know, you could pay or we could send lawyers to your house, blah, blah, blah. But there's really nothing you can do if they don't want to pay. So you basically have to either be a really, really good salesperson or you just have to be nice enough that people feel bad and want to pay you. That's kind of the angle I took.
But it's tough.
I was getting like bonuses because I convinced some woman while she was like sobbing on the phone with me because this was all of the money she had, but she just wanted to clear up the debt. That is $2,300 she needs and that she doesn't. I know what it's like to drain my savings. It's a horrible feeling.
There are also different state rules for debt collection. If you're calling somebody in Georgia, for instance, you have to say the company's full address during your greeting. All of her calls were monitored. And Alice was fired after 10 months for several of those kinds of violations. Now she is scrambling to find another job to help pay off her own debts.
I get calls from debt collectors all the time. It's just this presence in your life that it's not really affecting you, but it kind of is. Like, my credit's terrible.
Back at the Burbats, south of Chicago, the family's gotten in touch with a nonprofit to help them consolidate their debts.
Part of the agreement is that you won't incur any new debt.
Right.
So everything that we have to have the money to pay for.
Which is the way it ought to be, but that doesn't make things any easier. The Burbats' oldest daughter went off to college this fall. Their youngest goes next year. Tony Jr. has moved back into the basement with his fiancée. They're getting married on Inauguration Day, as it happens. Which brings us back to this point of this whole series, where the economy is headed under the next president. Yesterday on CNBC, President-elect Trump's pick for Treasury Secretary, Wall Street veteran Steven Mnuchin, had this to say about federal consumer banking regulations.
The number one problem with Dodd-Frank is it's way too complicated and it cuts back lending. So we want to strip back parts of Dodd-Frank that prevent banks from lending. And that'll be the number one priority on the regulatory side.
What about the Volcker?
Our series is called How the Deck is Stacked. It lives online. Previous stories, videos we've shot, all kinds of stuff. It's at our website, marketplace.org. Coming up,
we simply don't know whether the companies are being investigated as witnesses or as criminals.
The Korean corruption scandal and the Korean economy straight ahead. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's up 68 points today, about 0.3%, closed at 19,191. Financials drove that, as I said. The Nasdaq down 72 points, 1.3%, 52.51. Big tech companies, Amazon, Microsoft, and the like, took that one on the chin. The S&P 500 down 7 points, about 0.3%, 21.91. One company on everybody's minds, including ours, as we sit up top, the Carrier, the brand known for air conditioners, of course, but its parent company, United Technologies, also makes aircraft engines and escalators and weapons systems for the American military. United Technologies stock dropped 0.2% today. The Food and Drug Administration approved the party drug MDMA, as in ecstasy, for use in patients with PTSD. Current therapy is Zoloft, made by pharmaceutical giant Pfizer. Its stock dropped 0.2%. Today, you're listening to Marketplace.
Coming up this season on Codebreaker, do you think that this technology has saved you?
I'm probably alive because of it, but I don't know. I think it's probably saved me physically, but I think spiritually it probably bankrupted me.
We are back with a second season and a new question. Can it save us? We're asking this question of a different kind of technology every week. Subscribe now on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. Listen, decode, and decide.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. A story now about the internet and abuse on the internet, and one company doing something about it and it not going so well. Reddit, a site where users post links about what they're reading or watching or thinking online, and more importantly to our purposes, comments about those links. Reddit has found itself at the center of the abuse storm. Marketplace's senior tech correspondent Molly Wood is here to make me smart. Hey, Molly.
Hey, Kai.
All right, give me, and I'm serious about this, like the 40-second version of what's going on with Reddit and its CEO.
I am looking at my clock right now.
Okay.
What happened initially is that Reddit's CEO, a guy named Steve Hoffman, wrote this computer script so that whenever a member of this subreddit, a subgroup basically on Reddit, a pro-Trump group, cussed him out or abused him using his username,
yeah,
this script changed his username so that the message then cussed out the user. It substituted the user's name for his name. So then it looked like, I mean, this is like the classic 13-year-old boy troll, right, behavior. So then it looked like they were cussing themselves, like an idiot says what.
And we should say here that this is in a corner of Reddit, which the comments are vile and gross and horribly abusive.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, this has been a very controversial section of the website for months, if not longer, since certainly throughout the election campaign. And basically, the abuse started to center on him, the CEO. He created this script to try to change the messages. Obviously, that didn't go over very well because he was ultimately altering the business at the same time.
Yeah.
He apologized to that group a week ago. He apologized more yesterday. But then immediately came out with plans to curb some of those toxic users and remove them from the site.
Okay, so that gets to a thing that you and I have talked about before, which is Twitter specifically, but other places on the internet as well, not being able to control this. Are we now seeing perhaps, maybe, fingers crossed, something being done?
Well, we're seeing something being done, but I can't tell you that that's going to make it better in the short term, because what we're seeing is, absolutely, like you point out, we're seeing it on Reddit, we're seeing it on Twitter, we're seeing it on Facebook. Reddit, arguably the home of some of these behaviors, mm-hmm, that have now gotten out of control. It's as though these sites built a sort of Frankenstein monster. They said, here's a nice little corner for you on the web to say whatever you want. And And I think thought it might stay there, you know, but it has crept out onto the rest of the web, and Twitter has become a home for abuse, and Facebook has become a home for fake news and a game, you know, gaming the system to make your own money, to use the algorithm because there aren't any humans in charge. And so we're sort of seeing the almost inevitable outcome of a total lack of rules in society digitally playing out in the real world. And now we have to sort of face down how to deal with it.
All right, so here comes the really hard to answer question. Where do we go from here with this then?
Yeah, I mean, this is so messy. You've seen these sites are flailing, and they're flailing for good reason, because these aren't issues that anybody has really had to deal with before. Twitter is removing users. Reddit is going to crack down on users. But at the end of the day, these are customers of their product, and it's a product and a usage that they have created. And so it is a really tricky issue socially. It's a tricky issue for them as businesses, and it's really ultimately going to come down to a really strange and brand new free speech issue that we're probably going to talk about for months, if not years, to come.
Molly Wood, our senior tech correspondent. Thanks, Molly.
My pleasure, Kai.
One more thing about me and Molly before we move on. That thing I say every time she's here, make me smart. We and that phrase are going to be a podcast launching in, let me say that again, are going to be a podcast launching in January officially. Now, unofficially, if you call this unofficial, there's a feed in iTunes, more at marketplace.org/makemesmart. Check it out. Subscribe. Would you hook me up? President of South Korea, Park Geun-hye, as you might have heard, is in the middle of a huge corruption scandal. She has offered to resign in the face of impeachment threats in a story that is extending through the South Korean economy. Steve Evans of the BBC is in Seoul. Steve, it's good to speak with you.
And you too.
Give me the thumbnail sketch, would you, of how President Park has found herself in this situation.
She's got a very close friend, 40 years standing, who set up two foundations and then went to companies, big companies, household names, Samsung at the top, and said to these companies, I'm a friend of the president. You need to donate millions of dollars. Hmm. These foundations were ostensibly for things like the promotion of sport. But it turns out, in the view of the prosecutor, the allegation is for something much more personal.
The South Korean police have, as I understand it, raided the offices of the National Pension Fund and Samsung, as you mentioned, also the National Lottery. This is rippling across the South Korean economy.
It is. And they're raiding these offices because they want to know why particular companies gave money. Samsung, for example, gave about $3 million to these funds. Samsung and the other companies are not saying. We simply don't know whether the companies are being investigated, with having their collars fingered as witnesses or as criminals, really.
I imagine you can't turn around over there without reading or seeing news of this. And if you go out to the, you know, corner store, this is all people are talking about.
Yeah, absolutely the only thing. Apart from anything, every Saturday now, there is a huge demonstration in the center of Seoul, with demonstrators getting as close to the Blue House, as the presidential palace is called, as they possibly can. And these demonstrations really are huge.
Huh. This probably could not happen at a worse time, right? You've got North Korea literally right next door. You've got huge political change here in the United States, in one of South Korea's biggest trading partners. It seems the very recipe for uncertainty among the South Korean people.
There is uncertainty, and I think it's big uncertainty in a pretty dangerous situation. And it's partly because of this political crisis in Seoul, but it's also because of the things which President-elect Trump said before the election, on his way to winning the election. And he signaled, for example, that he thought that South Korea was getting its defense cheap, that Japan was getting its defense cheap. And he signaled that it might not be a bad thing if South Korea and Japan had nuclear weapons. So you think of Kim Jong-un, who is developing his nuclear Arsenal. And people here are saying, well, you know, where do we stand with this? Where do we stand with Mr. Trump? Is he really going to pull the Americans out? What's the policy going to be? We really do not know.
Steve Evans from the BBC in Seoul, South Korea. Steve, thanks very much.
You're very welcome.
This final note on the way out today, it's tempting to say it was the pumpkin spice lattes that did him in, but it seems it was just time. Starbucks CEO Howard Schultz announced today he is stepping down. He's going to become executive chairman and focus, the company said, on the brand's higher-end store, Starbucks Reserve, I think they're called. Little-known fact about Schultz, who, for the record, did not found Starbucks. Originally, he only allowed whole milk in stores. He said that's the way the Italians do it, and besides, I don't like the way skim milk tastes. True story. All right, we got to go. The Dow up 68 points today, about a 1/3%. The NASDAQ went the other way, 72 points down, 1 1/3%. The S&P 500 off 7 points, about a 1/3% there. John Buckley, Deirdre Depke, Eve Epstein, George Judson, Suzanne Levy, Andrea Seabrook, and Betsy Streisand are the Marketplace editing staff. Our interim managing editor is John Gordon. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.